This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
You can check our website. We'll link to his at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke and Renee Felsen and Shafe and Dina Gesder. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
It's 5 o'clock. You are listening to KBOO Portland, and the PM News is next.
Pickathon is an innovative music experience happening from Friday, August 2nd through Sunday, August 4th, just outside of Portland at the beautiful Pendarvis Farm. This one-of-a-kind weekend of music, food, and community features performing artists Sharon Van Etten, The Devil Makes Three, Sally Ford and The Sound Outside, The Foghorn String Band, and many, many more. Information about tickets, camping, and other performers can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Dr. Robert Amajoy and the Northwest Center for Colorectal Health, LLC, providing screening colonoscopy to help prevent colorectal cancer as well as minimally invasive management of colorectal disease. Offices in Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, an Oregon campaign to put a state marriage equality initiative on the 2014 ballot launches tomorrow.
The Bureau of Land Management postpones a timber sale in southwest Oregon following a recent lawsuit by the timber industry.
And U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder begins a national push for voting rights in the state of Texas.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 25th, 2013. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. Activists with the group Oregon United for Marriage are launching a campaign tomorrow to put marriage equality to a vote in Oregon. Their statewide petition campaign, Oregon Says I Do, aims to get enough signatures to put a measure on the 2014 ballot to make Oregon the first state with marriage equality in their constitution. Nearly a decade ago, Oregonians voted to define marriage as heterosexual in the state constitution, but those involved in the new campaign believe that time has passed. For more on the campaign, I spoke with Peter Zuckerman, press secretary with Oregon United for Marriage. What's the concrete goal for the petition campaign you're launching tomorrow in terms of numbers and what you're petitioning for?
We're aiming to gather 10,000 signatures in 10 days, and by July next year, like we this, need to gather 116,284 signatures. That number is required to put the freedom to marry on the ballot in November 2014.
Obviously, there are other states across the nation that have embraced marriage equality, including our regional neighbors, Washington and California. But the aim of your campaign is more ambitious, to make Oregon the first state to write marriage equality into the state constitution. Can you talk a little bit more about this distinction?
I can say that the fastest, quickest path to winning the freedom to marry in Oregon is through a vote of the people. And that vote will take discrimination out of the constitution. But I would say that the concept of the campaign is very similar to the campaigns in Washington and the other places, where going through a vote of the people, the signature gathering process is a great opportunity to tell people about the campaign, to identify leaders, and to, you know, get people excited about winning the freedom to marry. And it's a great opportunity, really, for lots of people to make a difference in the lives of others. And families have been waiting for this moment for years. For a lot of us, it's not really a political issue. It's about love, commitment, and family.
What has been the recent history of attempts towards state marriage equality legislation in Oregon?
Oregon has domestic partnership, but they're not the same. They're confusing to people, and they don't do what marriage does. I mean, marriage says family in a way that no other word does. And, you know, marriage matters to gay people in a similar way that it matters to everyone. In terms of the history of the movement, we have faced anti-gay measures before, and we're excited that this is the first time that we are able to proactively work to win the freedom to marry.
And how would you say that recent marriage equality victories, both in the Supreme Court and in the states, have set the stage for the reintroduction of this as potential legislation?
The momentum is tremendous. It's phenomenal. I mean, there's so much enthusiasm. We are the last state on the West Coast that does not yet have the freedom to marry. And, you know, really, when it comes down to it, it's about people getting to know their gay and lesbian friends and family members and colleagues and talking to them about why marriage matters. And, you know, the biggest momentum we have are that people are telling their stories and talking to people about why marriage means so much to them. And, you know, the way I think about it is it really comes down to the golden rule. I believe in treating others as one would want to be treated, and that includes allowing gay and lesbian couples to marry.
So the campaign to potentially make this a ballot initiative launches tomorrow, and I understand that there will be events across the state. Do you have any information on events perhaps in the Portland area?
Absolutely. In Portland, at the waterfront near Burnside, we will have a booth, and people can come by to sign a petition, to pick up a petition, to learn how to gather petition signatures, you know, and to learn how to get involved in the campaign. And, you know, if you believe in freedom, if you believe in treating others as one would want to be treated, you know, this is your chance to make a difference. And we hope a lot of people will stop by.
I've been speaking with Peter Zuckerman, the press secretary for Oregon United for Marriage. This has been Jen Chavez for KBOO News.
A Multnomah County resolution formally asking County Commissioner and Chairman Jeff Cogan to resign failed today. Unanimous consent among all five commissioners was required. Cogan, who has stated that he will not resign following a scandal involving an affair with a county employee, was the only lone no vote on the resolution. Other commissioners said the affair showed poor judgment and created a, quote, cloud of suspicion, doubt, and anger. Cogan apologized for what he called a big mistake that caused great emotional harm to many people and resulted in the resignation of Sonia Manis, the county employee with whom he had an affair. However, he also said that the affair does not impede his ability to govern and announced he will not be stepping down. Several public commenters demonstrated their agreement with Cogan's decision during the resolution's public hearing, saying that while he certainly had done wrong, his governmental decisions as commissioner have done good for the county, and that should not be overshadowed by the scandal. The only way now to remove Cogan from office would be via a recall election, a move that would require several large hurdles. Cogan will likely remain in office at least until the next election, but he must serve with four commissioners who have clearly demonstrated their contempt for his actions and their loss of trust in his judgment.
The U.S. Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, has postponed three timber sales in southwestern Oregon in the wake of a lawsuit brought by the timber industry. The judge ruled on June 26th that BLM had failed to comply with the 1937 O&C Act, which set aside 2.4 million acres of federally owned forest lands in 18 western Oregon counties for the benefit of those counties. The judge ordered BLM to sell timber in its Medford and Roseburg districts in order to meet the O&C Act's sustained yield requirements. That is, that sales should be equal but not exceed the timber production on given lands. However, BLM has postponed the sales while it pores over the implications of the judge's demand that they stop using their computer-generated models of northern spotted owl populations. KABU spoke with Scott Horngren, a staff attorney with the Portland-based American Forest Resource Council, one of the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, along with several timber companies, and also spoke with Joseph Vail, the executive director of the conservation group Klamath Siskiyou Wildlands Center, for their respective interpretations of this decision.
The judge required BLM to stop using the owl evaluation methodology because it was arbitrary and made some assumptions about where owls were located without actually knowing whether the owls were there. This resulted in significant restrictions on the BLM's options to find areas to place timber sales, and the judge said that you need to stop using a methodology that identifies virtual owls instead of real owls.
My name is Joseph Vail, and I'm the executive director of KS Wild. As a former wildlife surveyor myself, I know that it's tough to go out and find wildlife, and that oftentimes agencies do use habitat instead of actual locations of wildlife. My understanding of it is that without an owl estimation method to figure out where owls are on the landscape, the only other way to do it is the old-fashioned way, which is to go out and look for them. And so I'm not sure how this is going to play out and how the industry hopes to benefit from it, but perhaps they're banking on the idea that surveyors going out looking for owls will find less owls than the computer-generated models are anticipating are in the landscape, and therefore less habitat will need to be protected.
Conservationists also worry about the effect this ruling will have on old growth forests in the area covered by the timber sales and throughout the state.
I went to a court in the District of Columbia seeking to ramp up the logging on BLM lands in Southwest Oregon. A lot of the federal public lands in Southern Oregon, places where people go hiking or boating or fishing, are these ONC lands. And they made the claim to the court that they needed to cut a certain amount of timber from those ONC lands. And our concern is that that level of cut that court actually granted to the timber industry would require much more aggressive logging of large trees and indeed return to possible clear cutting of our public lands in Southern Oregon.
In the short term, probably not, because BLM has been designing its sales to focus on the younger forests, and the Northwest Forest Plan governs where the BLM can cut timber and what type of timber it can cut, and this decision by the court has not changed the Northwest Forest Plan.
Well, I think what it holds in store is perhaps a harbinger of what's to come, which is, you know, the industry being more aggressive in their quest to see aggressive logging on federal lands. And, you know, we'll probably see a lot more litigation from them to open up public lands and particularly to get into more controversial types of forestry, which is namely the cutting of old growth ancient forests and the renewed clear cutting of federal public lands. And we can see those things are definitely throughout their literature and their complaints to the courts.
The BLM maintains that the sales have been postponed, not canceled.
Oregon greenhouse gas emissions may finally be on the decline. That's according to new data from the Oregon Department of Environmental Quality. State emissions have been on the increase since the DEQ began tracking the numbers back in 1990, but the trend has reversed in recent years with small annual declines noted since 2010. The state had set a goal to begin emissions reduction by 2010 with a 75% reduction by 2015 as its aim. Gasoline and electricity are the two largest sources of greenhouse gas in Oregon homes, with food consumption and vehicle use accounting for almost half of all emissions. No surprise there, but the DEQ says if we want to accurately gauge our greenhouse footprint, we need to look well beyond our state's borders. The DEQ now uses much more comprehensive metrics to track Oregon's true emission rate. These metrics analyze in-state emissions and emissions from transportation, but they also track the impact of the products we consume from faraway lands. Consider the banana. It's just a piece of fruit, but if it was grown in Costa Rica, significant production and transportation efforts were required to get it from the jungle to your kitchen table. And that adds up to a large greenhouse footprint. What can Oregonians do to minimize the impact? The DE recommends drive less, use more efficiently your home, and buy only as much food as you will eat.
A new model of healthcare is catching on in rural Oregon that replaces solitary physicians and reactionary medicine with proactive healthcare teams. The new system, called the medical home model, is gaining popularity in small towns along the Oregon coast and has many people excited about a new form of healthcare that could save money and keep patients healthy. In conjunction with the Oregon News Service, KBOO's Casey Decker has more.
Touted as a way to get people better and more affordable medical care, and could even help ease the doctor shortage in rural Oregon. A growing number of small-town health clinics in Oregon are reorganizing their practices to become medical homes. Patients are able to call in a team, not just a doctor, for health questions and recommendations. On the coast, some clinics in the Columbia Pacific Coordinated Care Organization have adopted the medical home model. Mindy Stotlander, with Care Oregon, helped with the transition and says it's a more neighborly way to improve patient care.
The provider and the team that takes care of them knows about them. They know their family. They know their history. They can call them in for visits when they haven't been in for a long time and they're needing some up-to-date prevention or other health screenings.
She says the focus in a medical home is on staying healthy and managing chronic conditions, which also saves money, rather than waiting until a problem becomes serious to get care. And the care team looks beyond a person's medical chart, sometimes recommending social services or community activities. The medical home model has built-in challenges in rural areas, where clinics are small and there's a shortage of providers. Dr. Janet Patton is a family practitioner who moved from Ohio to Reedsport just to be part of Oregon's healthcare transformation. She thinks other doctors would do the same.
This is really exciting medicine, to be able to get people better care, the care that we know we can provide, that people deserve. That's going to be a recruiting benefit. I think people are going to want to be part of that as providers.
Patton thinks the biggest challenge isn't geography. It's getting people to see the healthcare system and their role in it differently.
What we're trying to do is shift patients to thinking, I am the most important member of my healthcare team. You know, how can you help me be healthier? You don't go to the doctor and say, fix me.
Patton says small towns do have one advantage in setting up medical homes. The providers are often well acquainted with patients and their families. For KBOO News, in association with the Oregon News Service, I'm Casey Decker.
Marijuana dispensaries in three Washington state counties were raided by the Drug Enforcement Administration Wednesday, despite a law decriminalizing cannabis use in the state earlier this year. The DEA maintains that the substance remains illegal under federal law, and they've executed search warrants at four Seattle-area storefronts as the result of a two-year-long investigation. One of the raided businesses had only opened a few weeks prior to the raid. No arrest warrants were served, nor were computers seized, but some dispensary workers have been subpoenaed for a trial that is slated to begin in September. The decision by federal authorities to crack down on marijuana in the United States, regardless of state or local law, is expected to ignite debate. ¶¶
Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio news after this newscast, followed by Wisdom of the Elders at 6. And at 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny with a high near 84 degrees. Tomorrow night will remain mostly clear with lows dropping to around 57 degrees.
It's 5:20 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
It's back. The Patriot Act, a grotesque, ever-mutating, hydra-headed monstrosity from the Bush-Cheney Little Shop of Horrors, has risen again, this time with an added twist of Orwellian intrusiveness from the Obamacans. Since 2006, Team Bush and then Team Obama have allowed the little-known, hugely powerful National Security Agency to run a daily dragnet through your and my phone calls. All on the hush-hush, of course, not informing us spies. Now exposed, leaders of both parties are pointing to the Patriot Act, saying that it makes this wholesale, everyday invasion of our privacy perfectly legal. When the story broke, Obama dissembled, calling these massive and routine violations of the Fourth Amendment modest intrusions that are worth us doing to make us more secure. He added disingenuously that Congress is regularly briefed about the program. In fact, only a handful of members are briefed, and they have been flatly lied to by Obama's Director of National Intelligence. Yet, Senator Dianne Feinstein loyally defends spying on Americans, claiming it protects us from terrorists. But then, she admitted she really doesn't know how the mountains of data are being used. This is nothing but a bottomless trust us swamp, created by the panicky passage and irresponsible reauthorization of the Patriot Act. Secretly seizing everyone's phone records is, as the ACLU put it, beyond Orwellian. As a New York Times editorial flatly and rightly says, the administration has now lost all credibility on this issue. But no administration can be trusted to restrain itself from abusing the unlimited power of the Patriot Act. This is Jim Hightower saying, it's not enough to fight NSA's outrageously invasive spying on us. The Patriot Act itself is a shameful betrayal of America's ideals, and it must be repealed.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
The U.S. Senate overwhelmingly passed a compromise deal yesterday on student loan interest rates that could prevent rates on Stafford loans from doubling this fall. The bill, which passed 81-18, reduces interest rates on undergraduate Stafford loans to just under 3.9%, graduate loans to 5.4%, and loans for parents of students to 6.4%. Those rates could rise with economic growth as they are tied to the yield of the 10-year Treasury note, a provision that concerned some Democrats enough to warrant a no vote. Most dissenting senators argue that the bill effectively tricks new students into borrowing at a relatively low rate, only to have interest rates rise in the following years as the economy improves. The approving legislators and President Obama both said the deal is an important compromise that will help reduce student debt and prevent interest rates from skyrocketing. Democrats fought for and won a provision within the compromise that caps the interest rates at 8.25% for undergrads, 9.5% for grad students, and 10.5% for parents, assuring that even during economic booms, students will not be massively indebted. The bill now goes to the House, where a similar bill passed earlier this year.
U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder announced today that the Justice Department's Civil Rights Division will urge a federal judge in Texas to require the state to get clearance from the federal government before changing any voting laws. Previously, the state was automatically subject to preclearance requirements under Sections 4 and 5 of the Voting Rights Act, but the Supreme Court struck down Section 4, the section determining which states must be pre-cleared, citing out-of-date formulas. until Congress creates new formulas to determine which states would be subject to pre-clearance regulation, the federal government has little control over states' individual voting laws. As a result, minority advocacy groups fear changes in some states will restrict the voting rights and limit the voice of minority voters. Holder said today that he would use the power he has left to ensure that the voting rights of all American citizens are protected. Holder is especially concerned with the redistricting in Texas, as recently proposed maps for the state were thrown out by a federal court in 2011 under the Voting Rights Act, and he fears that similar discriminatory laws could be pushed through. Texas Governor Rick Perry criticized the announcement, calling it a display of contempt for states' rights and the Supreme Court by Holder and by the Obama administration.
The French are famous for their love of protest, picketing, and revolution, but just how free are the members of the Republic to voice dissenting political opinions? Not quite free enough, says the European Court of Human Rights, and today French Parliament agreed. Last March, the court ruled that a recent criminal conviction in France against a man who insulted the president violated freedom of expression rights. In response, France has amended an antiquated law declaring it a crime to insult the president, public officials, and foreign dignitaries. Left-wing activist Hervé Ayon was recently convicted under the law. In 2008, Ayon stood before then-President Nicolas Sarkozy's passing motorcade with a sign reading, "Get lost, you idiot." Sarkozy had spoken the same words to a man who refused to shake his hand several months earlier. The expression soon became a popular leftist political slogan. Such insults were punishable by prison terms or fines of up to 45,000 euros in France, although the law hadn't been invoked in years. Ayon was arrested and convicted, and he faced a symbolic fine of 30 euros for the act. When his attempts to appeal the verdict failed, he brought his case all the way to the European Court. Laws prohibiting the insulting of public officials remain on the books in numerous countries around the world, including Spain, Thailand, Colombia, and Iran.
Five hackers, four Russians and one Ukrainian, were indicted today on multiple cases of wire fraud and various other computer-related crimes for stealing massive amounts of credit card data. The five hackers reportedly stole 160 million credit and debit card numbers and sold them and their associated data to middlemen, who, in turn, used the data to create fake cards to be used for large withdrawals or purchases. Two of the five are already in custody, with three at large, and United States prosecutors hope to capture and extradite all five to the United States for criminal prosecution. Since 2005, the hackers had been infiltrating databases of major international corporations and mining for relevant data, eventually stealing massive amounts of card data from dozens of companies. United States card numbers reportedly sold for about $10 each, Canadian data for $15, and European numbers for as much as $50 each. All five members of the group could face sentences of up to 60 years in jail if convicted. The monetary losses resulting from the group's heists have yet to be determined, but are already estimated to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
The death toll of the high-speed train crash in northwest Spain has risen to at least 80, including one American, according to regional officials. More than 170 others were injured, including five Americans, in the accident that caused Spanish Prime Minister Mariano Rajoy to call 3 days of national mourning. According to Spanish media, the train was traveling nearly 120 miles per hour when it hit the curve, which has a speed limit of just 49 miles per hour. Investigators have yet to determine whether human or mechanical error caused the train to hit the curve going more than twice the speed limit, but they have detained the driver pending formal investigation. 32 adults and 4 children remain in critical condition, and another 59 victims are still in the hospital. Spain has one of the world's most extensive and modern high-speed rail networks, which is why many are surprised that a train traveling from Madrid to the city of Ferrol would become the deadliest European mainline rail accident in more than 25 years. Celebrations for the Festival of St. James, a major holiday in the area that attracts thousands of Christian pilgrims from around the world, were canceled in response to the tragedy. President Obama offered his condolences and said that the U.S. will provide any assistance they can in the coming days.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Thursday, July 25th, 2013. A Palestinian civilian shot and injured by Israeli troops' gunfire in Gaza, and soldiers shoot tear gas into residents' homes in the West Bank. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A Palestinian young man was injured on Thursday morning when Israeli soldiers stationed at the northern borders of the Gaza Strip opened fire at him. Local sources reported that a Palestinian young man was working at the town of Beit Hanun near the borders with Israel when soldiers opened fire at him and injured him. Medical sources said that he sustained bullet wounds in his legs and was moved to a local hospital for treatment, where doctors described his injuries as moderate. In the West Bank, Israeli soldiers invaded the town of Al-Arub, located near the southern West Bank city of Hebron, on Thursday. Troops searched and ransacked homes and then fired tear gas into residents' homes. Many residents were treated for the effects of tear gas inhalation, local sources reported. Later, Israeli soldiers erected military checkpoints around Al-Arub and searched cars going in or out of the town. Soldiers gave no reason for today's attack. In other news, the International Solidarity Foundation for Human Rights reported that dozens of families of Palestinian detainees held by the Israeli army at the Nafha prison have been denied family visits after a young Palestinian woman refused to be strip-searched by soldiers. The human rights group said that the soldiers ordered the young woman to remove her clothes to be strip-searched, but she refused. One of her relatives tried to defend her, but the soldiers violently attacked and beat him. Witnesses said that the soldiers demanded dozens of women, mothers, wives, and sisters of the detainees to be strip-searched, but they refused and were forced back home. A total of three buses loaded with families of detainees in Nafha have been forced to return home without visiting their beloved ones, local sources reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, July 25th news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Seamus Sloan White and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Aaron J. Bernard, Casey Decker, Sam Bowman, and Robin Ryan. The producer is myself, Jen Chavez. Our engineer is Pat Epstein. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Jenka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Jen Chavez.
I'm Robert Barncourt. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, Ani and Lynn host Positively Revolting Talk Radio, a variety of topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, on One Land, Many Voices, hosts Zaha Hassan and Ned Rosh speak with local retired physician Bonnie Reagan about her recent trip to the Middle East. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Rosalie Regal talks about her life as an oral historian and activist and her book, Doing Time for Peace, Resistance, Family, and Community, which is based on interviews with peace activists who have spent time in jails and prisons. Thanks to all of you KABU members for your generous support for community radio. If you're not a KABU member yet, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Jen.
Good night, Robert.
Good night, Pat.
Good night.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, July 25th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, a federal court in New York considers a legal challenge to the NSA's spying programs. Detroit residents fight the city's bankruptcy, citing loss of public pensions and being shut out of the process. And we'll go to Egypt, where activists say the government has failed to address widespread sexual harassment against women. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Just weeks after the Supreme Court threw out an integral piece of the Voting Rights Act, the Justice Department announced today it would pursue a court order forcing Texas to get preclearance for changes to its voting laws. Attorney General Eric Holder said in a speech to the National Urban League the government would use another provision of the Voting Rights Act that allows judges to place jurisdictions on the preclearance list.
Based on the evidence of intentional racial discrimination that was presented just last year in the redistricting case of Texas v. Holder, as well as the history of pervasive voting-related discrimination against racial minorities that the Supreme Court itself has recognized, we believe that the state of Texas should be required to go through a preclearance process whenever it changes its voting laws and practices.
Holder said this legal action against Texas will not be its only effort to seek enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. A natural gas leak on a drilling platform in the Gulf of Mexico has stopped. Officials say the well, about 50 miles offshore of Louisiana, closed up naturally with sediment and sand. Despite this, flames could still be seen on the rig this afternoon. FSRN's Caroline Lewis has the latest.
Yesterday, there was talk of well owner Walter Oil and Gas drilling a relief well to stop the gas flow. But today, the federal agency managing the incident said the leak ceased on its own, and the fire has been reduced to a small flame fueled by the gas on deck. The Bureau of Safety and Environmental Enforcement and the U.S. Coast Guard have been monitoring from the air, but firefighters have been unable to approach due to safety concerns. Jonathan Henderson of the nonprofit Gulf Restoration Network says wells are frequently covered and abandoned, but can still threaten to reopen.
There's a lot of elements in the Gulf. There's storms and hurricanes that cause a lot of shifting of the seafloor, and these could impact the integrity of wells. So there's not enough watchdogging of the industry.
There are estimated to be more than 27,000 abandoned oil and gas wells in the Gulf of Mexico. Henderson adds that gas, although seen as less harmful than oil, could still potentially dissolve in the water and prove toxic to marine life. Caroline Lewis, FSRN, New Orleans.
An even larger crowd of demonstrators turned up at the Wisconsin State Capitol today after police on Wednesday arrested nearly two dozen residents for singing protest songs against Governor Scott Walker. Dozens sang and held signs in the lobby today, and many were arrested. This comes amidst ongoing battle between the Walker administration and his critics over access to the state building. FSRN's Molly Stintz has more from Madison.
Members of a group called the Solidarity Sing-Along have been protesting the Republican governor's policies for more than 2 years. They gather in the state capitol and sing protest songs each weekday at noon. But on Wednesday, Capitol Police cracked down on the singers and said they were assembling without a permit. Many of those arrested were elderly women, including Joan Kemble of Madison. Kemble is 80 years old and a regular participant in the sing-along.
The first arrests were pointed people who were leaders and people who spoke out very strongly and they considered real nuisances. I could tell you could see the people they arrested first, and the rest of us kept singing.
Earlier this month, in response to a lawsuit, a federal judge struck down the Walker administration's rules, barring more than 4 people from assembling in the Capitol without a permit. But the judge said the administration can require a permit for groups of more than 20. Molly Stentz, FSRN, Madison.
Hundreds of New Yorkers marched across the Brooklyn Bridge Wednesday afternoon in the latest protest against the closing of a State University of New York hospital. Several union members, community activists, and local politicians were arrested after sitting down to block traffic. Protesters say the hospital is violating a court order by slowly dismantling services at Long Island College Hospital, or LICH, leaving the local community without accessible medical facilities. Next Monday, the state Supreme Court is scheduled to hear a legal challenge to the hospital's efforts to scale back services and shut down. Hospital administration issued notices to about 650 workers yesterday morning, placing them on administrative leave. And finally today, Human Rights Watch issued a call for investigations into police violence against anti-government protesters and journalists in Bulgaria. Protests in the capital have been ongoing for nearly 7 weeks. On Tuesday night, more than a dozen people protesting outside the parliament building were injured. The human rights group says it has witnessed accounts stating riot police indiscriminately beat demonstrators with truncheons, hitting them with riot shields, and kicking them. 5 journalists were also beaten by police. The group is calling for calm on both sides. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. Today, a federal court in New York began hearing a legal challenge to the National Security Agency's sweeping domestic data collection program. The American Civil Liberties Union sued the NSA in June after documents leaked by Edward Snowden revealed that the government had been collecting and storing the phone records of millions of Verizon customers. As the ACLU and other privacy advocates tried to end these spying powers by taking the government agency to court, lawmakers in the House of Representatives tried this week to end them by cutting funding, using an amendment to the more than $500 billion military funding bill. Michigan Democrat John Conyers co-authored the amendment.
All this amendment is intended to do is to curtail the ongoing dragnet collection and storage of the personal records of innocent Americans. It does not defund the NSA, and it would continue to allow them to conduct full-fledged surveillance as long as it relates to an actual investigation.
The measure failed by just 12 votes despite broad support from many Democrats and Republicans. The House also rejected, by wider margins, amendments to prohibit the expansion of the Guantanamo Bay prison and end the indefinite detention of the 86 detainees who have been cleared for release. In Detroit, the city's bankruptcy case is set to move forward after a federal judge ruled Wednesday to halt legal challenges from public employees fighting to protect pensions. Republican Governor Rick Snyder and Detroit's emergency manager Kevin Orr say the bankruptcy is necessary to address some $18 billion in debt, but it could have vast implications for the city's 700,000 residents, including the more than 20,000 city employees who are owed pensions. For more, we're joined by W.J. Rideout, senior pastor with All God's People Church in Detroit. Welcome to FSRN.
Thank you, Dorian. How are you today?
Good. Good to have you back on the program. One of the attorneys who represents retired city workers who are aiming to protect their pensions said that most of her union's members are at or below $19,000 a year. Who is going to get hit hardest by this process of bankruptcy?
Well, and mostly it will be the laborers, those who have put their time in, those who are looking for their pensions to come back, and even city workers, firefighters, Detroit police officers, and these that have sewn into the pension funds.
And those are the ones we've seen in front of the courthouse, in the streets, launching these legal challenges to protect pensions from cuts from the bankruptcy process at this point.
Sure, absolutely. The city of Detroit has taken a great hit to try and take a stand to fight against bankruptcy. All of these things that are taking place right now are coming by way of the governor, Rick Snyder, and Kevin Orr, who he has assigned. If you look at the city of Detroit, we are crying out. We are hurting desperately to try and hold on to what we have. And at this point in time, we find that they're trying to take us to bankruptcy court, and they're trying to make us feel like that this is a way out, this is an option out, which is, when in fact is not. The bankruptcy is going to make things worse, not better. People are standing, we're protesting, we're demonstrating all over Detroit. We were with firefighters on yesterday. We were at bankruptcy court the other day with city workers and with some of the laborers and different ones and who are fighting for their pensions. So people in my congregation are going to be taking effect on this. They're going to be hurt. People in the community all across Detroit who trusted the city of Detroit and poured their money and their lives into hard work in this community, and they've given their all. So they expect to have their return that's due them.
Now, the argument from Governor Snyder and Emergency Manager Kevin Orr is that this is a painful but necessary process to go through. It's needed to improve city services. At any given time, 40% of Detroit's streetlights are out. There are problems with the 911 service, according to the Detroit Free Press. Pastor Rideout, your response to that argument for going forward with this bankruptcy?
You know,